Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Hi, Dan. How are you doing?
Good evening, Johan.
Hi, can you hear me?
Thank you for agreeing to this interview.
No, thank you for doing it. I really appreciate it. Would it be better for the sound quality if I spoke on headphones?
I think you should. Maybe you have speakers on. We're having an echo here.
Oh, hang on. Let me see if I... hang on a second. If I put my headphones on, it might stop. How about now? Have you got an echo still?
That sounds great. Let me just do the introduction that we normally do. I want to just mention that this episode of True Murder is brought to you by Squarespace, and Squarespace is the easiest way to create a beautiful website, blog, or online store for you and your ideas. Squarespace features an elegant interface, beautiful templates, and an incredible 24/7 customer support. Try Squarespace at squarespace.com and enter offer code TrueMurder at checkout to get 10% off your first purchase. Squarespace, build it beautiful. Thank you for agreeing to this interview, Johan. Thank you very much. I just want to do the synopsis of the book as we normally I normally do.
Sure. And thank you for being one of those few Americans who can say my name correctly as well.
Okay, Johan. It's Johan Hari?
Yeah, you're a very rare person who gets it right first time.
Well, thank you. Let me just introduce this incredible book. It is now 100 years since drugs were first banned in the United States. On the eve of this centenary, journalist Johan Hari set off on an epic three-year, 30,000-mile journey into the war on drugs. What he found is that more and more people all over the world have begun to recognize three startling truths. Drugs are not what we think they are, addiction is not what we think it is, and the drug war has very different motives to the ones we have seen on our television screens for so long. In Chasing the Scream, Hari reveals his discoveries entirely through the stories of people across the world whose lives have been transformed by this war. They range from a transsexual crack dealer in Brooklyn searching for her mother to a teenage hitman in Mexico searching for a way out. It begins with Hari's discovery that at the birth of the drug war, Billie Holiday was stalked and killed by the man who launched this crusade, and ends with the story of a brave doctor who has led his country to decriminalize every drug from cannabis to crack with remarkable results. Chasing the Scream lays bare what we really have been chasing in our century of drug war, in our hunger for drugs, and in our attempt to destroy them. This book will challenge and change how you think about one of the most controversial and consequential questions of our time. The book that we're featuring this evening is Chasing the Scream, The First and Last Days of the War on Drugs, with my special guest, journalist and author, Johan Hari. Thank you for agreeing to this interview, and let's get right into this incredible book.
Great, thank you.
Now, Johan, in 2002, you announced on your website that you were going to write your very first book about the war on drugs. Please tell us a little bit about your professional journalism background, and because I do know that this was not the first time that you wrote about the war on drugs in your journalism. So tell us about your professional background before that, so that we can have an adequate background as to how you came to this, to write this incredible book.
Well, it was 2012 that I put it, not 2002, but it's really interesting because I...
Pardon me, sorry.
That's okay. For many years, I'd been a newspaper columnist and I'd written about the war on drugs, and I'd written about it in what I think of as quite a polemical way. I would argue about why we should change the policy we had. And I wasn't really interested in writing a book like that. for lots of reasons, really. One of my earliest memories is of trying to wake up one of my relatives and not being able to. And as I got older, realizing we had addiction in my family and then other relatives becoming quite serious addicts. And I guess when I realized the centenary was coming up, as you said from reading the introduction, I just realized there were so many basic questions I didn't understand about this question, like, why were drugs banned in the first place? Why do we continue with this strategy of punishing drug users and addicts? What do the alternatives really look like? And what really causes drug use and drug addiction? And I kind of was realizing that, in a way, I didn't think I was going to get the answers to those questions by arguing with people, by looking for arguments. What I wanted to do was go and sit with people whose lives have been changed by this approach one way or another. And a kind of crazy mixture of people it turned out to be over the kind of 3.5 years I was doing the research and writing the book. And I kind of felt like I was going to find the answers not by arguing, but by sitting with people and listening to them and going back to them again and again and just trying to see the effects in the real world, not as if we're like in some kind of philosophy seminar, but in the real world. And I think part of the problem with this whole question is so many of the people involved in this have been totally dehumanized, you know, whether it's drug users, drug dealers, cops. You mentioned the guy I interviewed who was the only person to ever be at the heart of the deadliest Mexican drug cartel and get out and live to tell his story, albeit he lives in a very terrible way. And I kind of guess I just wanted to listen to those people and tell their stories, their human stories, in the hope that the best way to deal with dehumanization is to rehumanize people. And the way you rehumanize people is just to tell what their lives are like. And I kind of felt like if most people I knew could have met Chino, the incredible transsexual crack dealer in Brooklyn that I got to know over 3 years, former crack dealer, for example, or the extraordinary former street addict I met who started a revolution in Vancouver that completely transformed the city, I felt like they wouldn't be able to think about the drug war in the same way.
Now, before we introduce this fascinating cast of characters that really clearly demonstrate this story that unfolds in this Chasing the Scream, let's talk about the state of legalization of drugs in the world prior to 1914, and tell us about the Harrison Act and how we are going to enter into the 100-year century of this drug war. Tell us about that initiative to criminalize all drugs.
It's really interesting, this, right? It's hard to think about. Drugs were legal for almost all of human history, right? So in 1913, right, if you were an American, you could go to your local store and you could buy opiates, you could buy cocaine-based products. And the way I tell the story of how that changed is really through stories of two people. One is there was a doctor in California called Henry Smith Williams, who was nobody's idea of a liberal. He treated addicts both before drugs were banned and then after. He was not very sympathetic to addicts. He wasn't a particularly nice man, actually, to start with. But he noticed something that really struck him. When drugs were legal, he had patients who had addiction problems. They were a bit like alcoholics today. Their lives were diminished. But most of them had jobs. Most of them had lives. Most of them, there were not significant numbers of people dying of overdoses. Then drugs were banned for reasons I'll get back to in a minute, which had nothing to do with protecting addicts. And what he noticed is suddenly all sorts of problems got dramatically worse. When you ban drugs, they don't disappear. They're transferred from doctors and pharmacists to armed criminal gangs. Those armed criminal gangs will fight to control the patch, but more harmfully, even more harmfully for the addicts themselves, they massively increased the price. They jacked it up by 1,000%. And that meant that the addicts who'd previously been able to go to the local corner store to get their drugs, the local dime store, had to suddenly pay this massively inflated price. A lot of the women became prostitutes. A lot of the men started committing property crime. Also, the drugs started to be massively adulterated because criminals, you can't send health and safety inspectors in to check criminals smuggling things across the country. So you saw a massive increase in death among addicts. And Henry Smith Williams was really struck, the doctor in California was really struck by this. He actually started to campaign against the drug war, and we forget that this was a massively contested thing when it came in. It's not that the drugs were banned easily. There was a massive protest all over the United States. 20,000 doctors had to be rounded up and arrested and charged because they insisted on carrying on giving drugs to addicts because they could see what a disaster the drug war was. The mayor of Los Angeles stands in front of a heroin prescribing clinic and says, "You will not shut this down." And he was a popularly elected mayor. So this is a massively contested field, and which makes you think, well, why were drugs banned then? If it caused such a disaster, why were they banned? And what's fascinating is it's completely not for the reasons we think of. If you'd said to me 4 years ago, why were drugs banned? I would have guessed, well, people would give them the reasons that most people would give now. We don't want people to become addicted. We don't want kids to use drugs, that kind of thing. That barely comes up in the debate. The debate is overwhelmingly, as they saw it, African Americans and Chinese Americans were forgetting their place, using drugs and attacking white people. It was a massive race panic. There was a belief that African Americans were using cocaine and attacking white people all over the South. It was, in fact, the reason given why many sheriffs increased the caliber of the bullets they used, as one person said in an official statement. The cocaine N-word sure is hard to kill. This seems really odd. The way I tell it, this is really hard for me to get to understand at first. The way I tell it in the book is through the story of Billie Holiday and how she was stalked and basically helped to be killed by the guy who launched the drug war, Harry Anslinger. Yet in 1939, Billie Holiday stands on stage in New York City and she sings the song Strange Fruit, which your readers will know, your listeners will know, is a song against lynching. And you've got to understand her goddaughter, Lorraine Feather, explained to me, you've got to understand how shocking that was, right? Billie Holiday wasn't allowed to walk through the front door of that hotel. She had to go through the service elevator because she was African-American. To stand in front of a white audience at a time when most songs were like twee things like P.S. I Love You, and to sing a song about lynching was viscerally shocking. And that night, according to Billie's biographer, Julia Blackburn, the Federal Bureau of Narcotics says to her, stop singing this song. The man running it, Harry Anslinger, I think is the most influential person who no one's ever heard of. He basically invented the modern drug war. He took over the Department of Alcohol Prohibition just as alcohol prohibition was ending, and he needed to find a new cause, and he picks drugs. And he was driven by two really intense things, hatreds. One was of addicts and the other was of African Americans. And Billie Holiday to him was like the symbol of everything that had gone wrong. And Billie Holiday, because she'd grown up in Baltimore when it was a divided city, segregated city, and she hadn't been allowed into a lot of stores when she was a little girl, she had promised herself when she was a little girl she was never going to bow her head to any white man. And she basically said, screw you, I'm going to sing my song. And that's when the stalking of her that leads to her death begins.
Now, you talk about, you introduce Harry Anslinger, and you call Harry Anslinger part of this three characters of drug prohibition. If it was a Mount Rushmore, it'd be Harry Anslinger, and we'll get to Arnold Rothstein and also Billie Holiday. So the title of your book is Chasing the Scream. It's very interesting. Tell us about Harry Anslinger and his first hatred and fear of addiction. So tell us where this title of this book was derived from and that earliest compulsion that was born in Harry Anslinger.
Yeah, that's fascinating. When Harry Anslinger was a little boy, when he was, I think he was 10 or 11, he's grown up in a town called Altoona, a kind of rural town in Pennsylvania. And near where he lived, there was a farmer and his wife. And the farmer's wife had an opiate addiction. And one day, Harry Anslinger goes to this house, and the farmer says, the farmer's wife is screaming. And the farmer says, go to the store, goes, take our horse and cart, go to the store, go as fast as you can, buy the opiates, bring them back to us. So Harry Anslinger speeds there, he gets there as quick as he can, comes back, he gives the woman the opiates, and the woman calms down and she stops screaming. And Harry Anslinger, all his life, was haunted by this memory, and really haunted by his memory of that scream. And you know, the tragedy for me is in his belief that he was stopping those screams, he was actually creating an extraordinarily large number of screams instead. The other fascinating thing is, another thing that Harry Anslinger learned when he was a boy, where he was freakishly prescient, actually, is he worked on the railroads as a young man. He was quite impressive in some ways. He was from a pretty poor background. He insisted on working on the railroads and go to school every morning. And he and rose up. And he worked with Italian railroad workers, and he knew that they were terrified of something called the Mafia. And this is hard to remember now, but the Mafia was regarded as a deranged conspiracy theory. Like, J. Edgar Hoover denied his whole life that the Mafia even existed. It would be regarded right. The way we would regard, like, a kind of a truther or a birther or something. And Anslinger absolutely insisted on the reality of the Mafia. And he was one of the first major American law enforcement people to really prove that the mafia existed. Now, the great tragedy of Harry Anslinger is he believes he's at war with the mafia. Actually, he transferred this whole massive industry to them. He gave the mafia the biggest boost they've ever had in America to control the drug trade, this incredibly lucrative trade. So there's a kind of irony in that. I mean, Henry Smith Williams, the doctor who he destroyed, saw how much the mafia benefits from it, and he assumed that Harry Anslinger must be in the pay of the mafia, because I think the mafia were doing so well out of Anslinger's policies. Actually, that was wrong. But you can understand why Henry Smith Williams thought that.
Now, it's also, when I talked about his first hatred and his first fear, and you talked about, you touched on really what people think the war on drugs really was stemmed from, but really we talk about Harry and his racism towards Mexicans and blacks. Tell us about how the catalyst, the story that really helped him sell this war on drugs involving Mexico.
Well, there were lots of stories. I mean, he had initially said that cannabis was not harmful, not addictive, he wasn't bothered about it. But cocaine and heroin were really very minor in the United States at the time. So it's kind of hard to sustain a massive government department around this. Harry Anslinger suddenly announces that marijuana is worse than heroin. People may have seen the movie Reefer Madness, which is now regarded as like a comedy film. That's based on Anslinger's propaganda. He was a big fan of that. And he latched onto this case of a boy in Florida called Victor LaCarta, which was a massive story at the time. Huge, one of the biggest stories in America. Basically, Victor LaCarta was a young man in his early 20s, I believe, who hacked his family to death with an axe. And Anslinger announces, right, this is the result of him having smoked marijuana. We need to ban marijuana. We need to press on. And the Hearst newspapers, which is the kind of Fox News of its day, massively runs with this story. Years later, as I explained in the book, someone goes back and actually looks at this guy's psychiatric files. There's no evidence he even used marijuana. He had congenital insanity in his family. His family had actually been told to put him in a secure unit years before, and they'd insisted on keeping him at home. But the hysteria begins. Anslinger is a genius at taking the fears that are coursing through a society and really getting them to run through the kind of lightning conductor of his department. And it's using these fears and these hysterias and these largely false stories that Anslinger builds the modern drug war.
Now, Billie Holiday is this other central figure in this. And so tell us about Billie Holiday a little bit. You talk about it in your book about her early life and why she might have chose drugs as some sort of pain soother. So tell us about Billie Holiday and how Harry Anslinger and her lives collide.
Well, you're totally right. And it was incredibly moving. I tracked down everyone I could find who's still alive who knew Billie Holiday. And obviously I looked at the existing work on her as well. And it was so heartbreaking. Billie Holiday grew up in a part of Baltimore called Pigtown. It was the last part of the United States to not have a sewage system. It gives you some sense of what it was like. And when she was 10 years old, or 11 maybe, I think, she was raped by a stranger. And when the police came, they accused her of being a prostitute. And the guy who raped her was punished, but she was punished for longer. She was sent to this reformatory with these incredibly brutal nuns who locked her overnight in with a dead body. She ran away. She ran away to Harlem to find her mother. Her mother was working in a brothel, and Billie Holiday, at the age of 14, starts working in this brothel, being raped for money, alongside her mother. When the police catch her again, she's sent to prison. You know, think about the insanity of that. And Billie Holiday just needed to stun her grief, I think. And when, as we were saying before, when the Federal Bureau of Narcotics starts to stalk her, Harry Anslinger hated employing African-Americans, but you couldn't really send a white guy into Harlem to stalk Billie Holiday. So he employs this guy called Jimmy Fletcher, who was an African-American agent. And Jimmy Fletcher spends 2 years following her, and he watches her, and he gets to know her, dances with her. And because she was so amazing, Jimmy Fletcher fell in love with her. And his whole life, he felt ashamed of what he did to her. He busts her. She's put on trial. She said the trial was called the United States versus Billie Holiday, and that's how it felt. And she's sent to prison. And when she gets out, she can't perform because you needed a license to perform anywhere where alcohol was served, and Anslinger had it denied to her. He also got her husband and pimp, a disgusting man called Lewis Mackay, to start informing on her to Anslinger. And her friend Yolanda Bavan said to me, I'm paraphrasing the exact words are in the book, but something like, what's the cruelest thing you can do to a person is to take away the thing they love. And, you know, to take away singing from Billie Holiday was incredibly cruel. She found she went wherever they would have her, but it was very hard. And she relapses, of course. How could she not in that situation? When she's in her early 40s, she collapses in New York City, and she's taken to hospital. The first hospital turns her away, and the second hospital takes her. And she says to one of her friends that the narcotics agents aren't finished with her. She said, they're going to kill me in there. Don't let them. They're going to kill me in there. And I interviewed the last surviving person to be in that room where she died. They handcuffed her to the bed. They arrested her, even though they knew she had liver cancer. They arrested her on her deathbed. They took away all her flowers or her record player. They didn't let her friends in to see her. One of her friends, Maylie Dufty, managed to insist that she was given methadone because she'd gone into withdrawal. She started to recover. Then they cut off the methadone and she died. One of her friends said that she looked like she had been violently wrenched from life. But the thing that, to me, really helped me to think about this and to think about the addicts in my own life. You know, Billie Holiday never stopped singing that song. No matter what they did to her, she found somewhere to sing it. She would go anywhere they'd have her. And to know that addicts can be heroes, to know that addicts can be so strong. You know, there's the strength of just carrying on when you're in terrible pain, and then there's the strength of what Billie Holiday did. You know, where while we're talking, people all over the world are listening to Billie Holiday and feeling stronger. And that really helped me. I think it also helps us that story helps us to understand the madness of what we do to addicts. You know, I went out with a chain gang in Arizona of women who were forced to go out wearing T-shirts saying I was a drug addict and dig graves, right? Those women are never going to work again in the legal economy. What we did to Billie Holiday, we're doing all over the developed world. We give addicts criminal records, which is crazy. Take suffering people and make them suffer more in the hope that will make them stop. But also, it helps us understand the racial dynamics of the drug war. At the same time that Harry Anslinger finds out that Billie Holiday is an addict, he finds out that Judy Garland is a heroin addict. He tells Judy Garland she's going to be fine, that she should take slightly longer vacations, and reassures the studio that everything's okay. You know, spot the difference. That racism cuts right through to the present day. African Americans are no more likely to be drug dealers than anyone else, but they make up the overwhelming majority of people who go to prison for it. You know, those dynamics are still at work now.
Another central figure in this, because we talk about that incredible consequence of, you know, just the addict, the user being caught up in this drug war, but also what you say the drug war delivers this incredible unregulated market to organized crime. Yeah. So you talk about organized crime back in the beginning of this, after 1914, and then you also talk about the Zetas in Mexico, present day. So let's go back to Arnold Rothstein and how he came to
Arnold
power.
Arnold Rothstein is such a fascinating man. If Harry Anslinger is the inventor of the modern drug war, Arnold Rothstein is the inventor of modern drug dealing. When he was 3 years old, his father, who was a very respected Orthodox Jewish trader, walks into the nursery in his home, and he sees Arnold Rothstein, who was 3 years old, standing over his younger brother with a knife, you know, like considering attacking him, a big kitchen knife. And Arnold Rothstein was always going to be a psycho, right? But Arnold Rothstein was handed one of the biggest industries in the United States, and it was fascinating to me because when I was trying to recover the story of, you know, you can recover the story of Harry Anslinger because he kept records. I wanted to tell the story of how drug dealing was created, but Arnold Rothstein, you know, drug dealers don't have archives, right? But it really fascinated me because I was able to reconstruct it, partly because Arnold Rothstein so owned the NYPD, he actually would give quite open interviews where he talked about what he was doing. And also his wife, Carolyn, wrote a really fascinating memoir that was very hard to track down, but once I did find it, it was super interesting. Arnold Rothstein was an extremely cold and arrogant man. He rises through, he leaves home when he's 17, and basically becomes a kind of professional gambler. But he quite quickly realizes the people who really win in gambling are the people who own the casinos. So he sets up these casinos. But what he's a genius at initially is rigging bets. So he would bribe jockeys, he would bribe horse racing people. He is probably still now most famous for rigging the 1919 World Series. He bribed the Boston Red Sox to throw the game and made a fortune from that. Now, when drugs are banned, Arnold Rothstein is a smart guy. He can see a business opportunity when it's coming. He knew that alcohol prohibition was great, but it wasn't going to last forever. And he really latches onto the drug trade. And he's the first one to kind of really industrially import drugs and just kind of murder loads of people. He buys the police to the point where he's really above the law. At one point, he actually shoots at two NYPD officers and is mysteriously acquitted. My favorite mysterious story about Arnold Rothstein is he does this drug deal with a guy called Captain Alfred Lowenstein, who was the third richest man in America, the third richest man in the world, kind of like the Bill Gates of his time. He was so rich, he was a financier, that when the Germans seized Belgium during World War One, Lowenstein offered to buy it back from them. But to give a sense of how rich he wanted to buy Belgium. And when he comes to New York, and with Rothstein, he signs the biggest drug deal in history. And he flies back to Europe, and when the plane lands, Lowenstein isn't on it. And the crew say, oh, he went to the toilet and fell out. Does not seem very plausible. Presumably, whatever money Arnold Rothstein got in that drug deal, he kept. Gives you a sense of who Arnold Rothstein was. Arnold Rothstein was killed in 1929 by, we don't know who by. He's shot one day outside the Park Central Hotel in Manhattan at, 57th and Broadway, I think. And, you know, the police are basically too scared to investigate. And what's fascinating to me is you really see the dynamics of the drug war. You know, there's a writer called Charles Bowden, who sadly died recently, who pointed out the war on drugs creates a war for drugs. If you think about it, right, if you and me go into the local liquor store, I'm in Toronto, you know, where you are in Winnipeg, if we go to the local liquor store and we try to steal the beer or the vodka, they're just going to call the cops, right, and the cops will deal with us. If we go up to the local weed dealer or the local coke dealer and try to steal their goods, obviously they can't bring the police would arrest them. So they have to be violent, indeed they have to be terrifying, in order to stop people screwing with them. They don't have any recourse to the law. So it creates what the sociologist Philippe Bourgeois calls a culture of terror. And the first person to really see that is Rothstein. You have to be terrifying. You don't want to be having shootouts. So you want to be theatrically scary. And Rothstein is killed. And in a way, I think of that almost like the, you know, like the killing of the Archduke Ferdinand in Sarajevo. It's the first bullet in this global war, because what you get then is Arnold Rothstein does not die. Arnold Rothstein just gets to increasingly insane and psychotic versions of Arnold Rothstein. It's like Darwinian evolution armed with a little baggie of crack, because every gangster who kills the next one has to be tougher and harder than the one before. So Arnold Rothstein, I mean, wouldn't last 2 hours in Ciudad Juarez, where I went to do research in northern Mexico. You see this going up through the Crips and the Bloods, Pablo Escobar, Chapo Guzman, that you have this increasingly insane dynamic where there's an advantage. And I really learned that most from the serial killer I interviewed, Rosalio Retta. I went to a prison in Tyler County in Texas to interview him. He grew up in Laredo on the border of basically Laredo is on the Texas side and Nuevo Laredo is on the Mexican side. But they're basically the same city, you know, with a border between them, the kind of a highly artificial border between them. And when he was 13, kids used to kind of go across the border all the time because, you know, candies and sodas were cheaper there. And when he was 13, in circumstances that are disputed, but no one disputes it happened, he joins the Zetas, the deadliest Mexican drug cartel. And between the ages of 13 and 17, he kills around 70 people, 70, through beheading, through, horrendous. And it was a really fascinating process going to meet him. I go to this prison and it was kind of weird. I was only meant to have a short period of time with him, but the guard said to me, oh, I like your accent. You can stay as long as you want. So he also said to me, which I thought was slightly weird, they said, well, obviously, you know, he's killed 70 people. We can't leave you. Words like, you know, he's killed 70 people. We can't leave you on your own with him. They put me in the room and then they just left. Came back like 2 hours later. It's slightly annoying. But his story was super interesting about to understand. It's really one of the very few people in the world who can tell what life is like on the inside of a Mexican drug cartel and how that works.
This is what I found the most fascinating and probably the most, again, relevant to this audience, and it is the most profound example of the misstep, if an understatement, I know, but the extrapolation or the evolution from Rothstein to the Zetas. So tell us more about this camp, because you take us right into what he says is when he's 13, he's gone, instead of going to a summer camp like a lot of kids, he goes to this kind of camp and is trained. Tell us what he sees and what he's trained in specifically.
Yeah, it's really grim. When he was 15 years old in 2005, he goes to this summer camp. It's a Zeta training camp. I'll just read you one of the quotes from him. People can hear the full quotes on chasingthescreen.com, but they can hear the interview with him and some of the things he said. But he was telling me about beheading. There's times I've seen it done with a saw, blood everywhere when they start to hit the jugular, and he just clicks his fingers. It's everywhere. They put the head right there. The head still moves, makes faces and everything. I think the nerves, you can see inside the bone, everything's moving. It's like they've got worms. I've seen it move when it's on the ground. If he's making a screaming face, it stays like that sometimes. Sometimes it slacks off. What you're taught in these camps are the techniques of how to dissolve bodies, how to behead people, how to use the maximum possible violence. The camp slogan is, if I retreat, kill me. And that's really what he learns. He's kind of kept coked up, him and his friends, Jesse and Gabriel, who are also from Laredo. They're kept coked up. You never know where you're going to go. He worked for a guy called Miguel Trevino, who later became the head of the Zetas. And you're basically sent to kill people. You don't know who you're going to be sent to kill. I go through the story in the book of exactly what he did and how he did it. He regards this as very... He kind of tells two stories. So he basically, once he's in, he's taken to this that first day, he's taken to this Zeta workspace. There's about 30 people tied up. And to one side, they've got an oil drum, and they just burn them alive. And to the other side, there's people being cut to pieces. And the Zetas usually, they're there to torture other gang members or anyone who kind of angers them in order to find out safe houses, the routes, who they work for, what they do, that kind of thing. And after they're dead, they turn their bodies into what's called guiso, which is the Spanish word for stew. They kind of put them in kind of acid and dissolve them. And so Rosalio is taken there. Now, he says that he was kind of kidnapped, forced to go there, and made to kill someone. And once you're in, you're in. What the prosecution said against him is, you know, he wanted to sign up. He wanted to go. He was really excited to be a Zeta. Certainly when he's first arrested, that's what he says. He kind of talks. He's incredibly hyped up and amped up and compares himself to James Bond. And, you know, but one of the things that's fascinating as well, and something that really struck me when I went to Juarez, I was shown around by this guy called Julian Cardona, who's an amazing journalist. He's the Reuters correspondent in Juarez. And it's really weird. In some ways, Juarez, you know, it looks like any other, it looks like a normal American city. There's a KFC and a Wendy's and a, you know, you can buy a flat screen TV and, you know, it feels very familiar. And then you discover that the murder conviction rate is 2%. And that 2% didn't do it, you know. But it really struck me with Julian. I said to him at one point, after a few days in, he kept introducing me to people who'd been killed by the police. And I said, you know, Julian, this is important, but I've got to meet people who've been killed by the cartels. And he said, oh, Johan, you don't understand. In Juarez now, if the cartels want to kill someone, they just pay the police to do it. They aren't separate forces. And Rosalio told me that as well. He would very often go out with the police to carry out the massacres, that the police work for the Zetas. And the reason for that is, if you imagine a housing project in, I don't know, well, think about where Chino lived, right? A housing project in Brownsville, Brooklyn, where... You know, let's say 5 to 10% of the economy is in the hands of armed criminal gangs selling drugs. That housing project is going to be a miserable place to live. In Juarez, it's 70% of the economy, 70%. So the cartels can outbid the state. They can pay better wages than the state. So they basically become the state. And the way I kind of hit me is like, imagine if the Crips and the Bloods employed the LAPD to work for them, and therefore took over Los Angeles. That's basically what happened. And Rosalio really lived that. You know, they were the law. And what they're doing is they're torturing people, they're killing people, they send messages written in human flesh. You know, the cartels have a system of signals. So if you betray the cartel, they shoot you in the neck. If you talk too much, they shoot you in the mouth. If you're a spy, they shoot you in the ear. And it's like everybody is like a billboard advertising that your cartel is the most vicious. And it's really important to understand, this isn't just like, I don't know, Saw movie-style psychopathy, right? This isn't Jeffrey Dahmer. This is the result of the system that we've created. If you've got a system where a really popular product is in the hands of armed criminal gangs who compete to control that market and have no recourse to the law to protect their property, what happens is the way they compete is, if you are the person who's prepared to push a moral boundary a little bit further, if you're prepared to be that little bit more terrifying, you gain a brief competitive advantage. So if you are, for example, the first person who says, we're not going to just kill the other side, we're going to kill their wives, you get a brief advantage. If you say, you know what, we're not just going to kill their wives, we're going to kill their pregnant wives, then you get an advantage. If you say, you know what, we're going to kill their pregnant wives and put it on YouTube, then you get an advantage. You say, you know what, we're going to cut off their faces, sew their faces onto a football, and send the football to their family. That's something that actually happened. Again, you get a brief competitive advantage. It's really important to understand this is not just psychopathy, although clearly the people involved are deranged. It's the product of the system we've created. Milton Friedman said, you know, the Nobel Prize winning economist Milton Friedman said, Al Capone was the product of alcohol prohibition, the Crips and the Bloods are the product of drug prohibition. I would add the Zetas now as a product of that. And part of what went wrong with Rosario, and one of the reasons why he got out, actually, is because he was so coked up and so amped up by all this killing, that he actually started just kind of randomly killing people. He threw a hand grenade into a nightclub. And the Zetas don't want you just random. They don't want to employ Jeffrey Dahmer, right? Their violence is psychotic but targeted. And that's how Rosario had to get out. Again, this is disputed. He claims that to get out, he shot himself in the leg. He certainly has a bullet wound in his leg and showed it to me. He claims he shot himself in the leg in the hope that they would go, okay, well, you can just leave now. But, of course, they didn't. He claims he had to kind of kill his way out. And then he contacts the American police, and they get him back over the border, and he testifies. And he's serving two consecutive life sentences. He's in his mid-20s, and he's due to be out when he's in his 80s. He lives in constant solitary confinement because the minute they let him out among the prison population, he's immediately stabbed. Because anyway, all these other prisoners who are in there, mostly in there for life anyway, know that their family will get a huge amount of money from the Zetas. And even the guard said to me on the way in, something like, the exact words are on the website, but he was saying, like, it'd be nothing for these people to take a contract out on him here. You know, so it was really fascinating to get the insight into how, and Rosario was right to get out when he did. Jesse and Gabriel, his two friends who he grew up with, they were killed soon after by the Zetas. They call these kids, these child soldiers, the Zetas call them the Expendables, which is exactly, exactly right.
Now, I don't want to make it sound to the audience that this is not a very an optimistic book, but and yet it really is, and there's really some really nice stories in here of success and, again, optimism and hope. So let's talk about one of the most profound stories in here about the rat experiments of before, of probably in the 70s, concerning drugs and rats, and your friend doing the rat experiment in Rat Park. So tell us about that.
Yeah. If you had said to me 4 years ago, I don't know, what causes heroin addiction, I would have looked at you like you were a little bit simple-minded, and I would have said, well, heroin causes heroin addiction, right? It seems kind of obvious. For 100 years, we've been told a story about addiction that's become basically our kind of common sense. And I certainly believed that. I mean, we had addiction in my family. I had strong reason to believe it. But it was explained to me something that I couldn't really understand very well at first. If you or me, once we've finished this recording, Dan, if you step out onto the street, and you're hit by a car, God forbid, and you break your hip, you'll be taken to hospital, and you'll be given, quite likely, you'll be given a lot of diamorphine. Diamorphine is heroin. It's actually incredibly strong heroin. It's much stronger heroin than you ever get on the streets because it's medically pure.
Right.
You'll be given it for quite a long period of time. That's happening in every hospital. Anyone who's listening to this, anywhere in the developed world, that's happening, right?
Right.
If what we believe about addiction is right, that addiction is caused by a chemical hook in the drug, that like if you, me, and the next 20 people listening to this show, if we all used heroin together for 20 days, on day 21 we'd all be heroin addicts because our body would start to physically need the heroin. If that story is right, what should happen to those people in hospital? They should come out as addicts. They should be trying to score on the streets. That never happens, virtually never happens. You would have noticed your grandmother was not turned into a junkie by her hip replacement operation. So I didn't quite know what to do with this until I went to Vancouver and met, and lots of, you know, I know you're Canadian as well, lots of the heroes of my book are Canadian. And I met this extraordinary man called Bruce Alexander, who's a professor in Vancouver. And Bruce explained to me, the story about addiction that we've all come to believe and that Bruce used to believe comes from a series of experiments that were done earlier in the 20th century. They're really simple experiments. Your listeners can do them at home if they're feeling a little bit sadistic. You get a rat, and you put it in a cage and you give it two water bottles. One is just water and one is water laced with either heroin or cocaine. If you do that, the rat will almost always prefer the drugged water and almost always kill itself. So there you go. That's our theory of addiction. In the 70s, Bruce comes along and says, well, hang on a minute. We're putting the rat in an empty cage. It's got nothing to do except take the drugged water. Let's do this differently. So Bruce built Rat Park. Rat Park is like heaven for rats. Anything your rat could want, it's got in Rat Park. It's got loads of nice food. It's got loads of coloured balls. It's got loads of friends. It can have loads of sex. Anything a rat wants, it's got. And it's got both the water bottles. It's got drugged water and normal water. But here's what's fascinating. In Rat Park, the rats don't like the drugged water. They hardly ever use it. They never overdose. And they never use it in a way that looks compulsive. There's a really interesting human example of exactly the same principle that was going on, which I can tell you about in a minute. But what Bruce says is, this shows that both the right-wing theory of addiction and the left-wing theories of addiction are wrong. The right-wing theory of addiction is, you know, it's a moral failing, you party too hard, you become a hedonist, all that stuff. The left-wing theory is, it's a disease that takes over your brain, you become helpless. What Bruce says is, it's not your morality, it's not your brain, it's your cage. Addiction is largely an adaptation to your environment. Human beings need to bond with each other. We need to be connected. If you can't bond with the people around you because you're cut off, because you're traumatized, or for whatever reason, you will bond with something that gives you pleasure. You will connect with something. That might be drugs, that might be pornography, that might be a roulette wheel. But human beings are bonding creatures. And we need to bond. The human example that was happening at the same time, which is fascinating, and this forces us to rethink not just the drug war, but actually I think a lot about our society. The human example is called the Vietnam War. During the Vietnam War, 20% of all American troops were using heroin regularly. And if you look at the news reports from the time, they were really worried because they thought, oh my God, we're going to have hundreds of thousands of junkies on the streets of the United States when the war ends, because they believed the old theory of addiction. And what happened? They came home and they virtually all stopped. You know, the overwhelming majority, 95%, just stop. They don't go to rehab. They don't go into withdrawal. They just stop. Because if you're taken out of a hellish, pestilential jungle where you don't want to be and you could be killed at any moment, and you go back to your nice life in Wichita, Kansas, that's the equivalent of being taken out of the first cage and being put into Rat Park. And it's forced us to think about, well, why? Help me to think about the people in my life who are addicts. Why are so many of our fellow citizens unable to get through life without being drunk? Well, you know, you and me, we could be drunk now, right? We could be drinking vodka. We're not,
sure,
because we've got something we want to be present with in our lives. We've got jobs we love, we've got people we love, we've got things we want to do. Addicts can't bear to be present in their lives because their lives have become unbearable for one reason or another. And we've got a drug war that's built on the idea that we should make them suffer more. Gabor Mate, an amazing doctor who worked with hardcore addicts in Vancouver, said to me something like, if you wanted to design a system that would keep people addicted, you would design the system we have. You know, think about what we did to Billie Holiday. And that really blew my mind. I didn't know any of this really before I started.
Now, before we get into showing the dramatic difference in how some countries have chosen to look at addiction, I have to just talk about Squarespace just for a second, because this episode has been brought to you by Squarespace. I don't know if you happen to see the recent Super Bowl, but the dude, a.k.a. Jeff Bridges, has partnered with Squarespace to bring his unique project to life. Jeff and his musical friends have created an album of soothing and relaxing sounds, guided meditations, and stories designed to lull you to sleep. You can check it out at www.dreamingwithjeff.com. And you saw it was a really cool commercial at the Super Bowl. Now, Squarespace is simple, powerful, beautiful, 24/7 support via live chat and email. It's only $8 a month, and you get a free domain if you buy Squarespace for the entire year. It's got a responsive design. Your website scales to look great on any device, mobile device. Every website comes with a free online store, so that takes care of your commerce end of your website. And it has cover pages, a feature that allows you to set up a beautiful one-page online presence in just minutes. And so start a trial with the no credit card required and start building your website today. And when you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code TRUEMURDER to get yourself 10% off your first purchase. We thank Squarespace for their support of this episode of True Murder with Johan Hari and Squarespace. Build it beautiful. Okay, Johan, let's talk about the dramatic stories that you have of the difference in approaches. You touched on the BC safe injection site story. So why don't you first talk about, because I think that this will be very dramatic to see the difference, talk about Arizona and Marcia Powell cooking in a cage, and then we'll talk about the safe injection site in Portugal.
When I went to Arizona, I asked one of my standard questions, partly because the prison, part of the prison system there is run by a man called Joe Arpaio, who is the personal disciple of Harry Anslinger, which is partly where I wanted to go. And Joe Arpaio's face lit up when I mentioned Harry Anslinger. He was thrilled that someone knew who he was and loved him. When I went to Arizona, I interviewed a woman called Donna Leone Hamm, who is an amazing woman who works on prisoners' rights in Arizona. And I asked her one of my standard questions, which is like, tell me about something that shocked you in the time you've worked on this. And she's going through this long list, and somewhere down the list she said, there was the time they put that woman in a cage and cooked her, that was bad. And then she carried on. And I said, sorry, Donna, could you go back a second? There was a woman called Marcia Powell, about whom very little was known when I started doing the research for the book, except that she was a woman in her 40s who kept being busted, either for having meth or for prostituting herself to get meth. And one day in 2009, she wakes up in Perryville Prison in Arizona, which is not run by J.R. Pyle, I should point out, and she was suicidal. And the doctor refused to believe her, and they take her out and they put her in a holding cage, which is literally a cage exposed to the desert, right? This is Arizona. And they left her there, and she cried, and she begged for water, she messed herself, and she collapsed. And by the time they called an ambulance, she had been cooked. No one was ever criminally punished for what was done to Marcia Powell. And I then went and tracked down the father of her children and got the story of her life, which is very like Billie Holiday's life. She had been thrown out when she was 13. She'd lived on the beach. She'd almost certainly been a child prostitute. Again, a person who was trying to stun her pain. And the thought that this was done to her. She'd actually had a period of her life when she got clean. She was clean for more than a year. She went back to Arizona to get her kids back because they had been taken into care by the state. And she was busted for an old marijuana conviction and her whole life unraveled again. I compared that to the places I went to which had gone beyond the war on drugs. You mentioned Vancouver. There's an incredible story there about how a homeless street addict started an uprising in Vancouver that completely changed the city. In the year 2000, there was a homeless street addict called Bud Osborne who was watching his friends die all around him. People would use behind dumpsters because you didn't want the cops to see you, but obviously the cops can't see you and you start to OD, no one can see you, and you're found like a day later, you're dead. And Bud thought, I have to do something about this, but he also thought, I'm just a homeless junkie, what can I do? But Bud had a really simple idea. He just said, he got together a group of the addicts and when we're not using, which is most of the time, why don't we have a schedule where we'll parade up and down the alleyways, and if we spot someone ODing, we'll just call an ambulance. And they started to do it. It goes on for a few months, and the overdose rate started to really fall on the downtown inside, which your listeners will know is an area with a huge number of addicts in it. And that was great in itself, but partly it meant the addicts started going, oh, maybe we're not the kind of pieces of rubbish people say we are. Maybe we're people who could do something positive. They started to turn up at public meetings where they were discussing like the menace of the addicts. And they'd sit at the back, and after a little while, they'd put up their hand and say, oh, I think you're talking about us. Is there anything we could do differently? And sometimes people would be appalled, and sometimes people would say, oh, you leave your needles lying around. So they said, fine, we'll extend the patrol, and we'll collect the needles. And they started doing it. But what was amazing is Bud started to learn that in Frankfurt, in Germany, they'd opened safe injecting rooms. Where people could go and use their heroin legally and be monitored by doctors. And there'd been a huge fall in the death rate. And Bud realized, well, we have to have this in Vancouver, but there hadn't been anything like it in North America since Anslinger. And so they started to stalk the mayor of Vancouver, who was a right-wing, very wealthy businessman called Philip Owen. Picture Mitt Romney and you've got the idea. A man who said that addicts should be taken and detained at the local military base, right? And for 2 years, everywhere Philip Owen goes in public, they just stalk him, and they carry a coffin, And the coffin says something like, "Who will die next, Philip Owen, before you open a safe-injecting drug room?" And after 2 years of this, they're starting to lose heart. And one day, Philip Owen, his eternal credit, says, "Who the hell are these people?" And he goes incognito to the downtown east side, and he meets a load of addicts. And then he goes to meet Milton Friedman, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, to explain how the drug war works to him. And Philip Owen comes back, and he holds a press conference, and he has the chief of police, the coroner, and an addict. And he says, "I'm never going to talk about addiction again without having addicts with me. And we're going to open the first safe injecting drug room in North America. We're going to have the most compassionate drug policies in North America. We're going to turn things around." And they open the first safe injecting drug room in North America. And it's been 10 years now. Oh, I should say, Philip Owen was deselected by his own political party because they were so horrified by what he'd done. And it's 10 years now. It's 10 years when I went there. Overdose has fallen by 80%, 80%. An average life expectancy on the downtown east side is up by 10 years. And when I, you know, when not long after I got to know him quite well and interviewed him a lot, Bud Osborne, the addict who'd started this uprising, died. And they sealed off the streets of the downtown east side where he had lived homeless. And they had this incredible memorial service for him. And there were a lot of people in the crowd that day who knew that they were alive because of what Bud started. And I would say to anyone listening to this who thinks about the drug war, this is a bad policy, but this is so big. We're so powerless. We all feel powerless sometimes. I'd say you are so much more powerful than you know. Bud was a homeless street addict. He started an uprising that has completely transformed his city. There's so much we can do about this. What happened to Rosalio? What happened to Billie Holiday? What happened to all these people? None of this has to happen. We can choose an alternative if we want to.
Now let's talk about, before we talk about another incredible character, Lee Maddox in the U.S. and her transformation in thinking, let's go to Portugal with this, again, real-life experiment in decriminalization of all drugs. So let's tell us about Portugal and how they came to this and what was their state before this. You talk about their heroin rates and their addiction problem. So tell us about Portugal. Yeah.
In the year 2000, Portugal had one of the worst drug problems in Europe. 1% of the population was addicted to heroin, much worse than anything in the US. And every year they tried the American way. They cracked down harder, they arrested more people, and every year the problem got worse. So finally they set up a panel of scientists and doctors led by an extraordinary man called João Goulão. And they basically said, "Look, tell us what we'll genuinely deal with this problem." And the panel came back and it said, "Decriminalize everything, from cannabis to crack, the whole lot, but," and this is the crucial next step, "use all the money we currently spend on arresting drug addicts, imprisoning drug addicts, trying drug addicts, take all that money and spend it on really good drug treatment." And it's not really what we think of as drug treatment of in North America and Western Europe. Partly it's things like rehab and psychological support, which are useful, but mainly it's drug treatment that learns the lesson of Rat Park. It's drug addiction that is geared entirely towards reconnecting addicts with society. If you think about what we were saying about why you and I are not drunk now, it's because we've got something to do. The goal of the Portuguese decriminalization was to make sure that every addict had some purpose in their life, had something to wake up for in the morning. So one of the main planks of it is just subsidized jobs. Say you used to be you're a smack addict, you used to have used to be a mechanic. They'll go to a garage and they'll say, "If you employ this guy for a year, we will pay half his wages." You know, the microloans for addicts to set up businesses was another big thing. And again, the results are in. It's been nearly 15 years. Injecting drug use is down by 50%, 50%. Overdose is massively down. HIV transmission is massively down. One of the most moving interviews I did was with a man called João Figueira, who led the opposition to the ending the drug war in Portugal. And it was said a lot of the things that a lot of your listeners will totally understandably be thinking. He said, surely if we, he's the top drug cop, he said, surely if we decriminalize, you'll have a massive increase in drug use and all the problems that come with it. And what he said to me was, the exact words are on the website, he said, everything I said would happen didn't happen. And everything the other side said would happen did. And he talked about how he regretted that he was ashamed that he'd spent 20 years arresting drug users. And he hoped the whole world followed Portugal's example.
Now, I just introduced Lee Maddox, and How did she become a soldier in the war on drugs? That's a fascinating story of your book, and I don't want you to go too far into it, but what motivated her to get so seriously involved, and then what was the event that changed her direction drastically in this war?
Lee Maddox signs up to be a cop in Baltimore, Maryland, because her best friend is murdered by what she believes is a drug gang, and Lee Maddox, her sole motive is, I want to bankrupt these drug gangs, I want to destroy them. And she becomes a militant drug warrior. She's like Harry Anslinger's dream girl. But Lee Maddox is an honest person, and she notices two things. One is, they only really bust black people. And secondly, if you're a cop and you arrest a rapist, the next week there's less rape in your town. If you're a cop and you arrest a drug dealer, well, there's no less drug dealing, everyone knows that. But something even weirder happens. The murder rate actually goes up. And Lee couldn't really figure it out. But then she kind of realized, well, what you do is you trigger a turf war. What you have is, if you have a patch controlled by a gangster and you knock out that gangster, rival drug gangs will fight each other for it. And huge numbers of people die in the crossfire, and, of course, dealers die. So Lee now quit the police force, retrained as a lawyer, and now spends her time, she's such an amazing person, getting the criminal records wherever she can quashed of people for drug convictions.
What was interesting, too, is that you introduce her to an organization called LEAP. Just briefly tell us about LEAP.
Oh, LEAP was something Lee was already engaged with, but LEAP it stands for Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And I would really recommend anyone checking out their website. They're an extraordinary group. They are former cops, former judges, former prosecutors who have fought the drug war and seen from the inside that it's a disaster, and we need to regulate the market in drugs and reclaim it from armed criminal gangs.
Now, a practical example of that, you put in the book about Uruguay. So tell us how Uruguay came to legalize marijuana and what that model looks like, and what was the result?
I interviewed President Mujica. He's such an incredible man. Mujica was the leader of the kind of guerrilla resistance in Uruguay in the 70s. He was imprisoned by the dictatorship and kept at the bottom of a well for 2 years. And he emerges to become this hugely popular politician. He's like the Mandela of South America. And he lived in a shack the whole time he was president. I went to the shack. It's no exaggeration to say Stephen Harper and David Cameron would not keep their shoes in the place where President Mujica lived. And Mujica, the reason why Mujica wants to legalize marijuana and did legalize marijuana is because he saw supply routes for drugs move around the whole time, right? And he knew if there's a huge crackdown on the Mexican border and the supply route moves and starts to go through Uruguay, they were completely defenseless. They've got a weak military. There's no military that can defend. And Mexico had quite a strong military. You can't defend against it. And he said the only thing we can do to protect ourselves is to legalize. So he became the first president since Anslinger's crusade to fully legalize marijuana. The same thing has happened in Colorado and Washington. The only time I ever saw my father cry was the day my dad had lived in Berlin for a long time. And I came home when I was 10 years old, and he was watching the Berlin Wall come down. And he was crying, and he thought, I never thought I'd see this. And when I heard the result from Washington and Colorado, they voted to legalize marijuana, that came into my mind, and it felt like the first axe swung into the Berlin Wall of the drug war. And I think this whole thing is going to come down. Now, that doesn't mean, obviously, that we're going to have all drugs available to all people. No one wants there to be a crack aisle in CVS. We have different kinds of regulation for different kinds of drugs. So Switzerland has legalized heroin for addicts. That doesn't mean you can go into the store and buy it. It means if you're an addict, you'll be assigned to a clinic, and you can go into the clinic and use it there, and you can't take it out. And they have had no fatal overdoses from heroin since they started doing that in those clinics. None. An overdose rate of zero. It gives you a sense of how well these policies work when you introduce them.
This book is not only just chronicled the facts of the last 100 years. It is a call to action. And you also describe the historical fight in June 1969, Stonewall Inn in Greenwich Village, and what Barack Obama had said about that. Tell us about what he said and why you have included it and why you think it has a parallel to that.
That's so interesting, yeah. If you think about, you have 2,000 years of gay people being persecuted horrifically. And one day in 1963, a bunch of drag queens, hard to think of a more despised and marginalized group, just one day they're like, you know what, you're not going to treat us like this anymore. And they start to riot. And you've got to remember, in 1963, the pro-gay position was to say, they're not evil, they're sick, right? That was the pro-gay position. Sure. Something like gay marriage, they didn't even ask for that. Nobody even had a concept of that, because it would have seemed like saying you want to live on Mars, right?
Yeah.
Some of those people who started that riot lived to see the introduction of gay marriage. Things can change in unimaginably positive ways. We are, we're in the equivalent of 1963 with ending the drug war, not the equivalent of, 2012. But, I think we'll live to see the end of this, adaptation and adoption of policy where you have liberty for drug users who are not harmed and love and compassion for addicts that help them to turn their lives around.
One of the things you really talk about and stress in this book is that the theory, and again, we talked about it in Rat Park, but the practical solution to addiction, if we, no matter if we use that word or discount that word, but if we just use it for the practical purposes of this argument, what is the most single thing that we have to deal with, and is illustrated in the Rat Park experiment, with addiction and trying to cease addiction or reduce it?
The opposite of addiction is not sobriety. The opposite of addiction is connection. When you are a connected person with healthy and thriving connections in your life that nourish you and make you feel good and give you meaning, you want to be present in your life. I've seen this with the addicts I love. I've seen this in Portugal. I've seen this in Switzerland. We have a model that thinks that the way to deal with addicts is to make them suffer more. In Arizona, in that prison, in Tent City, I went to one of the solitary confinement blocks, which they call the hole. And these women are just shut in there for a month at a time. And I suddenly thought, oh my God, this is the closest you could possibly get to a literal human recreation of those first cages that guarantees that people stayed addicted. The whole model we've had about how to deal with addicts, I think it'll be remembered like Bedlam, like putting mentally ill people in cages so people can go and look at them. So there's no one solution for addiction. It's an incredibly complex phenomenon. We need to have a very broad menu. Some of it needs to be, subsidized jobs, like in Portugal. Some of it needs to be prescription for people who can't stop, like in Switzerland. Some of it needs to be 12-step programs. And, support for sobriety, for the people who want that, and that can be fantastic. You need to have a very broad range of options. Anyone who tells you there's one solution for addiction is a charlatan, but the underlying core of it is to help people connect and bond and find meaning.
With all the efforts of organizations like LEAP and all the people and the awareness of citizenry, and now in the last 100 years and growing in momentum, you have the Colorado and the Washington State initiatives. You have the opposition party in Canada as a main platform for the next election is legalization of marijuana.
Yeah.
With all those efforts, what does the marijuana initiative itself, because we're talking about legalization of all drugs as a concept, how important is the marijuana legalization movement and success to this entire movement?
Oh, it's massively, massively important. It's like, if you think about the gay rights struggle goes in stages, and you have things like decriminalization of homosexuality is the first step, and you end with gay marriage and the complete, the achievement of the goals. It's important to understand when we talk about legalizing all drugs, I just want to reiterate, that doesn't mean all drugs being available like marijuana should be available. So if you think about, we already have all the existing modes of regulation we need. We regulate alcohol one way. We regulate sleeping pills another way, right? You can't just go into CVS and buy really powerful sleeping pills. I've actually got bad jet lag at the moment. I wish I could. You can't. You have to go to the doctor to get a prescription for that. So obviously it works differently with different drugs. So with marijuana, with I would suggest ecstasy and certain party drugs, you could regulate them like alcohol. Clearly, with something like heroin, you would regulate it much more like sleeping pills, or actually have the Swiss model, which is even tighter than sleeping pills, but you have to go to a clinic to use it. Now, there's a debate about what you would do about things like crack and meth, which are clearly very physically destructive drugs. With something like that, what I would recommend would be probably, and we need to experiment very cautiously, but some variant on what they have in Vancouver, what you'd do is you'd have safe spaces where you could go and get those drugs that you wouldn't be allowed to leave while you were under the influence of them. I would probably recommend that, given that the reality is that people are doing it anyway, we want them to use it in a place where there's doctors, where they can be given support, where they can be given help to stop, where they're not chaotic and on the streets. I think that would probably be the best model. So legalization, it's very important to understand, legalization is a way of regulating and controlling, because at the moment what we have is total anarchy. Unknown criminals sell unknown chemicals to unknown users, all in the dark, with disastrous consequences for everyone. We need to restore the order that prevailed before the drug war. We need to go back to the situation that Henry Smith Williams knew about and undo, kind of run the clock backwards on that.
I agree, and I want to thank you for the incredible amount of research and time and effort that you put into this book. And like I said previously, this is not just a book chronicling some facts. This is a real call to action and to get involved. So as you do put in the book, you leave a website for people that want to get involved. So could you give us that address? And if they want to connect with you, I know you're on Facebook. Tell us how people can connect with you. Tell us about your website and what they might find there.
Great. So chasingthescream.com, you can listen to the interviews with all the people that I've been talking about. So the serial killer in Juarez, the serial killer who is from northern Mexico, Rosario Reza, and President Mujica, a whole range of people. And you can also find, actually, if people want to get involved, there's things they can do. Also, there's a Facebook page for it, which is just the Facebook page is Chasing the Scream. Which is the, you know, gives you loads, you get updates, you can watch loads of interviews with me where I've talked about this. And I just want to thank you, Dan, for reading the book so closely. And I was hugely influenced by the true crime genre. Some of the books that I most loved as a teenager, there's an amazing true crime book that I shouldn't really be recommending other people's books, I'll be told off by my publisher, but there's an extraordinary British true crime writer, I'm sure you know his work, Brian Masters. He's best known for writing that amazing biography of Dennis Nilsen. But actually, he wrote a book that I really hope is still in print called She Must Have Known, The Trial of Rosemary West, which is about the trial of the wife of a British serial killer, who is herself a serial killer, which is a really incredible book. And I'm sure that this book has a lot of the DNA of true crime, because I just love true crime. I think it's a fascinating and brilliant and hugely underrated genre.
Well, I think that's what I always talk about, is that you know, true crime genre really is history. It's just a specific, I guess, it's still just history. And so as this book really clearly explains, you really get a reminder of the history, and it's all tied in. What I found interesting was last week's episode was Murder, Inc. And so when you talked about Arnold Rothstein, the most prolific group of murderers had their opportunity in 1930 to 1940 because of prohibition.
We've transferred one of the biggest industries in the world into the hands of some of the worst people in the world, and we don't have to do that. Like, would you rather the drug trade was controlled by Rosario Reta and his bosses, or by your local doctor? And it was so striking to me, the tremendous sense of relief I felt when I went to the places going after the drug war, and I couldn't quite figure it out. I would go to these places where drugs had been legalized, and I would speak to the people involved, and it was a weird feeling, and I couldn't place it. And only after a little while, I suddenly thought, oh, I'm bored. Suddenly, they've taken this thing that seems so violent, and they've made it boring. What an amazing achievement. You know, that actually, what happens after the drug war is you get, you know, like one of the guys, I think it was Steve Fox, who led the Colorado legalization campaign, said something like, in an interview, not with me, said something like, you know, we spent all these years arguing about gang warfare and killing and slaughter. Now we spend our time arguing about what the size of a font on a brownie package should be. That's what happens when you end the drug war. You know, it becomes banal, you know, which is exactly how it should be, you know?
Absolutely, and I think this is going to be part of that broader recognition. I think everybody from a grandmother suffering from an illness and is given their first brownie, or everybody that's affected by an arrest and, like you say, unemployable and leads to all kinds of incredible problems, the drug war has to end. And I applaud you for this extraordinary, her incredible effort to be able to put this book together, Chasing the Scream. I want to thank you very much. The First and Last Days of the War on Drugs. Thank you very much, Johan Hari, for coming on and talking about Chasing the Scream.
That was a massive pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, and you have a great evening.
Great. And Dan, you should, Brian Masters is still alive, you know. I can try to find his details for you if you want. He would be a great interview for you.
I would love that. I'm a big fan of his book about Dennis Nielsen. And
amazing.
If you look at my background, you'll see why.
Yeah, that book about Rosemary West is just absolutely extraordinary. I'll see if I can figure out. He must be, I think he's nearly 90, but he, I'll try to track that to business him. Dan, will you also send me a link when it's, I'll tweet whenever it's good for you to the interview. Is that okay?
Absolutely. I will send you all those details. Well, Johan, thank you very much for this incredible interview, and you have a great night.
Brilliant. Thanks, Dan. You too. Thanks.
Good night.
Bye.